I'd like to start by thanking the organizers for putting together a wonderful program. And I'll be telling you about a series of works that I've done over, say, the past 4 or 5 years about first passage properties of extreme values. And I guess it'd be three different works done with Paul Kropivsky from BU, Nathan Lemons, who's a fellow colleague at Los Alamos, and Pearson Miller, who's an undergraduate at Yale and is now a graduate student at MIT. So I'll start with actually some empirical data and try to motivate the study and why you study records and extreme values and first passage and so on. I hope it doesn't get you too bored. But then I'll talk about first is incremental records, and then I'll talk about ordered records, and then ordered records again. The first study will be about actually a special class of uncorrelated random variable. The second study will be generic to all types of uncorrelated random variables. And the last study will be about one special class of correlated random variables. And I'll tell you, it's Brownian motion. So for records and the first passage statistics as a data analysis tool. So in this talk, I'll be speaking about records and about running records rather interchangeably. So when you think about the record, you think about the left, is that I give you a series of n variables. The record is the largest variable, okay, obviously. But then I'm a kinetic theory kind of person, and I think about it as a dynamical process where I'm adding variables one at a time. And as I'm adding variables one at a time, I'm actually generating records as a series. So as we're adding variables one at a time, we're actually generating a series of records. So in fact, there are here four running records. Of course, the running records increase monotonically. So the record is the largest variable in a series, and the running record is the largest variable to date. When you think about this as the time arrow. Let's think about independent and identically distributed variables. So those variables are drawn from the distribution row. For the most part, I'm going to be talking about continuous variables so that we don't have ties, but the results largely apply for all types of variables. And just to demonstrate how beautiful the subject is, let's think about how many running records do we have. So if I have one variable, we have one running record. If we have two variables, well, if they are independent, then the second is bigger than the first with probably one half. So we have one plus one half running records. And you can generalize this argument, of course, and you probably, most of you have seen it. The average number of running records is the harmonic numbers, 1 plus 1 half plus blah blah plus 1 over n, and it grows logarithmically in the size of the sequence. Okay, so generically, the numbers of record is a very small number, so grows logarithmically. And this behavior, this result, exact result, is independent of the distribution function from which the variables are drawn from. And the numbers of records is quite small. So let me demonstrate how we use that for data analysis. Let's look at earthquakes and over the past 100 years, when they happen. And we'll restrict our attention to very large earthquakes. So very large is bigger than 7. And there are about close to 2,000 of those in the last 100 years. And here they are. This is if I restrict to magnitude 8.5 and larger, 8 and larger, 7.5 and larger. This is the annual rate of events. So there are about 15 events per year. And why we're interested in this? Because we look at those very massive earthquakes and we see those big cluster of activity in the 60s and another cluster in 2010. Aha, those events must be correlated. Must be. So here's the question. Are massive earthquakes correlated? So we do something very simple, and we look at this 2,000 events bigger than 7, and we look at the recurrence time, how much time between events. So people call it inter-event time or the recurrence time. And instead, let's say we wait a year for such an event. We wait 2 years. Now we have two records. We wait a year now, we still have two records and so on. So how many records we have in the waiting times? and we just count as a function of consecutive events, say 10 or 100, or that's as far as we can go up to about 500. And amazing, if you look at their records, magnitude 7 and larger, you see that they follow this harmonic number almost perfectly. And this is beautiful because mostly people look at the distribution of inter-event time to show whether it's Poisson or not. This is simpler. You can do it by hand. It's perfect. However, if you go to magnitude 5 and larger, in which, and this is just 40 years, you can see clearly a deviation from a random distribution. Of course, 5, it's out of those 37,000, maybe 30,000 are aftershocks. They are correlated events. So we can attribute that to aftershock, but for the large events, there's no significant difference that we can tell between those lines, that there's any difference between uncorrelated events and the time between earthquakes. So, and this is just one figure. There's a whole many more figures. You can look at the distribution of event time. Everything shows you that those 2,000 magnitude 7 and larger are... there's just no way to distinguish them from a random process. And what happens every 20 or 40 years, there's a cluster of events and aftershocks, and then there's hundreds of papers saying, oh, this correlation, an earthquake in Sumatra generated an earthquake in Chile, and this is a big deal. So this is an example of how records can be a useful tool for analyzing data. All right. So that's the first part. The second part is first passage of my title. What is a first passage process? You look at a fluctuating quantity. So the fluctuating quantity is this blue. And you set a threshold, okay, on this. And you say whenever this fluctuating quantity reaches threshold for the first time, this process is over. I call it the first passage process, okay? So the process by which a fluctuating quantity reaches a threshold for the first time, the first passage probability is the probability that is function of time. You reach or not, this, some people call it the survival probability. And there's the total first passage probability, which can be either 1 or lesser than 1. There's no guarantee that you ever reach that. Also, the first passage time, which is the mean duration of this process, it can be finite or infinite. And also, this there's no guarantee that you ever reach it. So that in that case, the probability is smaller than 1. All right. So here's the first example of a first passage process for extreme events, and it's incremental records. So when you think about records, you think about sports, and you tend to think that to break a world record, the better the record is, the longer time it takes to break the record. You might wait 5 years to longer and longer and longer, and also that you might imagine that the record, in a sense, the improvement in the record becomes smaller and smaller. And here it is. Here's evidence that there's some truth to it. So this is the last six world records in the marathon. Five of those six were broken in the same marathon. Anybody knows in which marathon would that be? Any Germans?
Berlin.
Yes. And... as you can see, this improvement, 43 seconds, 29, 27, they're monotonically decreasing. Okay, I just got lucky. I looked first at the 100 meters, and because of Usain Bolt, there was no chance. So those are incremental. So every record improves upon previous record by a yet smaller amount. So here's the question. Are those incremental sequences of record, are they common? So when I told you that I'll look at... in the IIDs, I look here at the simplest thing, like when you push RAND on a Fortran on a computer, it gives you a number between 0 and 1. That's precisely the distribution I look at. So those numbers are going to be between 0 and 1. So we have a sequence of random variables. Of course, we have the latest record, which is the running record. And then you have the latest increment. And the way I define the latest increment is there's memory. You remember what it was, the latest increment. So here the increment was 0.4, here gone 0.2, 0.1. So this is an incremental sequence. This is monotonically increasing and monotonically decreasing. So what is the probability that all records are incremental? So very simple question. I press on the Fortran, I press 1,000 times. I get a number between 0 and 1. I count the records. I see, count the increments and ask, are the records incremental? Or that means that the increments in the record, are they decreasing monotonically? What's the probability for that? And by the way, you can do that for the earthquake data. Here's what the Monte Carlo computer tells us. It's a power of 0.317621. In fact, we will find this number analytically. So there's what statistical physicists call an exponent, a very interesting, intriguing, enticing exponent. And we're going to find it. So actually, it decays like a power law. It's not exponential. It's not all that unlikely to find an incremental sequence of records. So what's the beauty of this is, we have something to go after. And this problem is parameter free. So we're going to try and go hunting for this. This is Texas. We're going to try and go and hunt this exponent. So the hunt begins with some very trivial observations. So let's look at the uniform distributions between 0 and 1. If you want to know, here's a cheat. If you want to know what's the average record for such numbers, what you have to do is place them equally spaced on the interval 0 to 1, and you will notice that the size of this interval is 1 over n plus 1. So the average record is n over n plus 1. This is an exact result, which you can get immediately by noticing that the probability all the records are just the cumulative distribution is x to the n. But the fact that it is exactly 1 over n plus 1 is not interesting. Let's erase that one. This can be 7. I don't care. What I care about is this exponent, is that the gap between the biggest record and 1 shrinks like 1 over n, as it should. So that's the. But we also know that since if I want that the record is smaller than x, and I have n variable, I have to stick all those n variable in the interval 0 to x. This is very important, because that's how we start solving the problem. Of course, if we have one record, it is by definition incremental. If we have two records, we have two scenarios. Scenario one is that x1 is bigger than x2. We're done. Because we have another one record, by definition, it's incremental. If x2 is bigger than x1, then I have to guarantee that the difference between x2 and x1 is smaller than the difference between x1 and 0. And those are, now we're going to take, this is the unit square, x1 and x2. This is the scenario 1, which x1 bigger than x2. This is the line x1 equal x2. This is the line x2 equal to x1. And if we're going to have two records, we must reside here. So those variables, x1 and x2, must sit in this trapezoid whose area is exactly 3/4x squared. So that's the cumulative distribution for incremental records that are smaller than x with two variables. So we solve the problem with two variables. The answer is 3/4. That doesn't sound all that exotic. But this is when having undergraduate students from Ivy League really helps, because that lots of stamina. The kid went and calculated it in a cube. I said, I'm giving up. This is beyond my, I'm just too old for this. Because there's many, many other conditions. X3 minus X2 is bigger than X2 minus smaller than X2 minus X1. Lots of planes. Anyway, it's a polyhedra in 3D. You could do this, but it doesn't matter. In fact, once you notice that, you realize that the answer must be of this form, because all the conditions that I've been telling you about, they're all invariant under this transformation. You know, I told you x2 minus x1 is smaller than x1 minus 0. Those are all the incrementality conditions. So already we found something remarkable. If we take the universe of all records of all uncorrelated variables with no condition whatsoever, the distribution of those records is x to the n, the cumulative distribution normalized, x to the n. If we take the universe of all incremental records, and we normalize by the probability of having, by the entropy. That's basically entropy for these sequences, which is really small. We expect that it is highly unlikely to find an incremental sequence. So once we shave the overall entropy of this universe, they're identical. Amazing. I mean, why would that be? But that's what it is. So the distribution, if I just look at the size of the records for incremental records and the size of a record without any condition, it's the same statistics. You can't tell them apart. So that's clue number one. It doesn't seem that it's all that helpful because we don't know this entropy, this probability, that survival probability the sequence survive as an incremental records. So I call it the statistics of the records as standard. So that's clue number one in this. And then, okay, we even look numerically, four variable, it's perfect. So there's an exponential distribution. Remember I told you that the scaling is 1 over n, so once I scale by this 1 over n, it's purely exponential as it should be. That doesn't seem all that useful. Okay. So the bottom line is you have to do work to get this number, 0.0176. It's not going to come out just by cute observations. And you have to really respect what the problem is. And the problem is a problem with memory. There's a memory. You always remember the last increment. So you have to take this memory and inject it into your theory. You're not going to have a theory without memory that's going to tell you what's happened in the process with memory. So the memory is actually very simple. You have to look at the distribution, a probability density, of sequences with n variable that have a record x and increment y. There's two variables we care about. That's it. We have to put it into the theory. So once we know this probability, once we integrate over the record and over the increment, of course, increment smaller than the record, we will get this entropy or the survival probability. We will get it. And of course, I wouldn't be telling you if there's no closed equation for this quantity. So a closed equation is something I can actually write down and is exact. So here's this quantity as I go. It's a recursion equation. As I go from n variable to n plus 1, first thing is a simple term that tells me that there's no new record. I add another variable, there's no new record, the probability for that is x. That's perfect. The second one is where the memory is going to come in. When I set a new record, y prime is going to be the old increment. So I have to integrate over the old increment. And the old increment has to be bigger than the new increment. So that's why y prime is bigger than y. This condition is basically telling me that the old increment was smaller than the old record. This is what it is. It's linear. And now we're going to go to the... We heard a lot about the differential equation method. It's a recursion equation. We're going to convert it into... we're going to say n is extremely large in the limit of n goes to infinity. We're going to subtract Sn from here and here, and we're going to have a differential equation. So it's an integral differential equations. But still, I have three variables. I have time, number of variables, record, and increment. What are we going to do about that? Miraculously, I'm going to tell you that we're going to reduce that to one variable. So it's a two-step process. How do we reduce the problem from three variables to two? Scaling. That's sort of vanilla, because we know that the increment goes like n minus 1. The record, 1 minus the record, goes like n minus 1. So we can use that scaling to turn this recursion equation into a equation, in a sense, in the infinite n limit. And the prefactor here is, of course, the overall entropy or the survival probability. Nothing here is really all that intelligent. This is just, obviously, this is going to be scaling. But it looks horrible, actually. So we reduce the problem from 3 to 2, and we have no idea how to solve it. Now comes the miracle. We're going to look for a factorizing solution. Essentially, we are going to assume that the records and the increment are uncorrelated in the large n limit, which happens to be true. I don't know why. They start perfectly correlated. At time n equals 0, n equals 1, the record equals the increment. There's a lot of memory initially, but there's no memory between, or no correlation between those two variables. They just don't talk to each other when the sequence is infinitely long. You might say that it's an ansatz, it's a guess for the solution. And now this trapezoid comes very handy because the trapezoid told us that the scaling function is exponential. So we're going to use that, exploit that knowledge. It must be exponential. If they aren't correlated, the one is exponential, it has to be exponential. We're going to exploit that. So we're going to take that ansatz. And the key here is that indeed psi and z is psi, a function of s, a function of z. Plug it into this horrible looking equation, and we turn it into a first order integral differential equation, which basically we're done. We can convert that, of course, to a second-order ODE because we'll call that a new function. So now we manage to turn the problem from three variable to one. We have one ODE for the, essentially the distribution of the increment. And we can solve that. There are two solutions. One, in, when you go to z is infinity, one is a constant, one is a power law. This one is the one that actually wins. And we know the initial condition. Basically, the initial condition, you plug into this, and it's just like a shooting method. You want your solution to go into this solution. That excludes this one and gives you a selection. In essence, this exponent that we have, 0.31, this beautiful number, beta 0.3176, is an eigenvalue of this equation with this particular initial condition. So, and you will see this over and over. In all of the problem I'll tell you about, the first passage exponents, that's what they are, first passage exponents, they are eigenvalues of something. Of something rather hidden that you have to dig for. And another thing you learn from this is that the distribution of the increment has a broad power law tail. Just as an aside, for if I take all, forget about incremental all records, then nu is zero, this beta is zero, then the distribution of the increments is one of y square in scale units. That's probably exists somewhere in some nice textbook. So the increments can be relatively large, and the problem reduced to a second-order ODE. Now, some numerical evidence that we're confident there's no correlation. So this is the solution I told you, this shooting solution, and the distribution of the increments, and you start with some derivative, and you can see that the numerics and the theory are perfectly in agreement. We also verified that, indeed, the correlation between the size of the record and the size of the increment becomes zero when it goes to very large sequences. So to recap this first part, I studied the probability that sequence of record is incremental. It's a linear evolution equation, but with memory. Dynamic formulation, you treat the sequence length as time. Similarity solution for distribution of records. Probability that the sequence of record incremental decays as a power law with sequence length. A power law exponent is non-trivial, obtained analytically. And the distribution of the record increments is broad. And that sort of told me that first passage properties are really interesting and they reveal hidden features. So here's the next one. Is a little bit more general. It's not just about flat distribution. It's a problem that applies to all IIDs. And it's very simple. I was thinking about temperature records. And the idea was the following. You want to solve the global warming. So we want to see that in 2001, the temperatures was always lower than 2002. Because 2002 got warmer than 2001. So how do you do this? One way to do this is to look at the temperature at each day. Compare January 1st in 2001 and January 1st, 2002. January 2nd with January 2nd, and so on and so forth. That's one way to do it. Later I'll tell you why that's a bad idea, that the probability for that is exponentially small. And if you want to have a signal, I'm proposing something slightly different. Let's compare the record high on January 1st with the record high on January 1st of the 2 years. Just keep tracking of the record high. The record high in January 2nd compared to the record high, and you keep doing that for the entire year. So that's what I'm proposing as a new measure. So let's compare the running record. And how does it look if this is the temperature versus time? Those are the actual variables, blue and red. And the record, the running record, forms a sort of a staircase. Yeah? And another record, another staircase. And we want basically that one staircase encloses the other. Yes?
Please explain the process again. I didn't understand.
Okay. So think again about numbers between 0 and 1, because it's easy. Those are those numbers. So this is 0, this is 1.
Two sequences are variable.
Two sequences, variable. The variables are independent from each other, and the sequences are independent from each other. They're all, so you have, now you track for the red variable the record. So this is going to be up. Here is a new record. You go up. Here's a new record, you go up. No record up to here. Yeah? So that's the record, the red, 2001. Now you do the same thing for the blues, 2002. And you create two staircases. I slightly shifted them so you can differentiate them. And you want the red staircase to always be larger than the blue staircase. So here it is. I mean, you have, those are the variable X and Y, capital X, capital Y. Xn is the maximum of this one. Y is the maximum of this one. So this is blue, this is red. And you request that the running record are always ordered. X1 bigger than Y1, X2 bigger than Y2, blah, blah, blah. Is that clear? Yeah, please ask me questions if I'm going too fast. So I emphasize the blue variables are uncorrelated, the red are uncorrelated, and then the blue and red are uncorrelated. There are basically two n variables drawn from the same distribution, except we label one of them, half of them red, half of them blue, and we call them two different sequences. Okay? So our question would be, what is the probability that one sequence is always ahead? Okay? Let's say one, the red, always ahead. All right. So we're going to arrange them from left to right, small, big, just arrange them. And we're going to assume, again, it's a survival probability. Sn is the probability that n variables of the reds are always ahead of the blue in the running record. So as I'm going from n variable, or 2n variable, to 2n plus 2, it's very, very simple. If the reds have always been ahead, all I have to guarantee is that the next blue is not the larger of all 2n variables. Completely trivial. So the recursion equation for the survival probability can be satisfies this form. So 1 over 2n is the probability that this blue is the largest of all. This is by the same argument that we got to argue that the record, the average number of record is the harmonic number, 1 plus a half, by the same argument. So we have to guarantee that this blue just doesn't overtake everybody. That's it. We don't even have to guarantee that this red, I'm not labeling them, it doesn't matter. I don't have to guarantee that this red is the latest one. We know already that a red is ahead of all the blues when we have 4 and 4 balls. Now we're going to go from 4 to 5. We have to guarantee that this one doesn't overtake everybody. That's it. So here is the recursion. And this recursion is very, I'm sure, very well known to many of you, or most of you. It's the Sparrow-Anderson. It's basically the probability that a random walk, 2n length random walk, never crosses the origin. It's always in the positive territory. Is it? I don't even know that there is really a deep connection between the two problems, although you're sitting and says, obviously, this is, must be related. And well, it's related by this recursion, obviously. So we'll use Stirling, and it decays like 1 over square root of n. So we have a trivial exponent in the language of statistical physics, a half, for two variables. And all right. And then what's very nice is that this behavior is independent of the parent distribution. It holds for all IIDs. This formula holds for all IIDs. That the running records of one set is bigger, always bigger than others. Okay. And now, why did I tell you that comparing day by day will be a bad idea compared to comparing the records? Because the probability that day one is bigger than more hotter than day two, and day three, day four, and so on, is exponentially small. The probability that the red variables are always bigger than the blues is minuscule. So this is going to be half, another half, it's a quarter, 1/8. It's the probability that the reds are always every microscopically bigger than the blues, it's 1 over 2 to the n. So this probability is exponentially small. So ordered records are far more likely than ordered variables, which is because the records are so far and few in between. That, of course, is the reason. Of course, records are the records themselves are correlated. Even if you start with the random variables, the variables aren't correlated, but the records are correlated. So I'll conclude that ordered record might be better suited for data analysis. Okay. All right, now we go to three variables, and that's where the problem appears to become interesting, because again, the power law distribution, power law rear its head. And we find that the survival probability, that now we have three staircases, that they are all perfectly ordered. The red always better than the blue always better than the green, decays as a power law with this exponent 1.3029. And here is simulation and theory, and that tells you there is a theory for it. So how do we do this? In order to do this, again, we have to go inside the guts of the problem, but not to open too much of the guts. And the least amount that we can open up is to ask how many reds are ahead of the first blue. So again, I'm ordering smallest to largest. The leading sequence will be red, the median will be the blue, and the green will be the laggard. So this is the leading red, this is the leading blue, and this is the leading green. And essentially, all we're going to have to find out is what is the rank of the leading blue. So we're going to, in general, you see here we had closed equation for Sn, closed equation, life was really nice. That's no longer the case. So closed equation for the survival probability alone are not feasible. We have to focus on the rank of the median record, so J, how many variables here. The rank of the trailing record, that apparently is irrelevant for our purposes. And we just have to count this joint probability. So this is the minimal quantity that I can attack that is not trivial, but will reveal this entropy or survival probability, that the records are ordered and the rank of the median record equal J. Of course, if I know this quantity, I know the survival probability. Okay? So, if I have N variables, there can be one red or two or three up to N. Okay? And so that's why the summation goes from 1 to N. All right, so there are, now, again, we're going to go from N variables to N plus 1. And we're going to add a new red, add a new blue, and add a new green. And there are four scenarios. One, we add the new red, we add it here, and it doesn't make any difference. And the new blue, red here, nothing changes. This is sort of an all order n to the zero event, because when n is very, very large, the probability that you break a record is like 1 over n for any record. The probability you break two records is 1 over n squared, and three records, 1 over n cubed. We don't care about the third record, so we are concerned with those three events. So we have another event in which you break the red increases the sequence here from J to J plus 1, or that the blue comes up here or here. And another event is both of them sort of mess up. We're not going to worry about that because it's asymptotically negligible. This event of O and zero will essentially cancel the left-hand side. What are we doing here? Think about, just forget this equation and focus on this table. If we have three variables and there are IIDs, so there are six orderings, 1, 2, 3, 1, 3, 2, yeah, 3 factorial. Only in one of them, 1 is better than 2 and 2 is better than 3. So the probability is 1/6. Or if I normalize by 3n factorial, there's one configuration, one permutation. This is just combinatorics. There's one permutation in which the orders are records, or the records are ordered. If I have two variables, I have 6 factorial, 720 ways to arrange these numbers, 1 through 6. But I'm requiring that one is better than, and I'm ordering them. And all those configurations are equally likely because it's IIDs. So I'm requiring that one is better than two and two better than three on the first stage. And in addition to that, I'm requiring that the maximum at one and four, it's modulo three, one and four, is better than a maximum of two and five. And the maximum at two and five is better than the maximum of three and six. So I have all this. It turns out that there are 58 such configuration, and you can see this grows rather out of hand, but we have to enumerate this, and what I'm telling you is that the number we're looking at, Sn, is basically some power law with crazy exponent. All right. So I'm not expecting you to absorb all this because it's a little tedious, but what I want you to appreciate is that again, there's some miracle that occurs, because otherwise we cannot solve those problems. And the miracle is that the rank becomes completely uncorrelated from the sequence length. This means the statistics of the number of reds, consecutive reds, become universal when you go to infinite sequences. That's really what allows us to solve the problem. And here is the evidence for that. We look at the rank distribution. We normalize here by the survival probability. So this rank distribution looks like that. And as you go to very, very large sequences, it becomes independent independent of n. Of course, if I had here a logarithmic scale, you would see that at the tail there's big deviations. So we did large enough sequences that we're confident with that. So again, it's going to be a factorizing solution. a factorizing solution, which we have the survival probability times the rank. We know that the survival probability is power law. We know the rank is normalized. And you end up with this recursion equation. And again, the exponent sigma, which we're after, is an eigenvalue of this recursion, which is very, very nice. The rest actually is super standard. You do a generating function, you solve the generating function, you look at the tail, you look at the behavior of this generating function near z equals 0 or z equals 1, and you want to guarantee that there's regular behavior, and in fact this behavior, this number is irrational, which indicates that you can have, you know, usually a generating function will be 0 plus az plus bz squared plus... You don't want anything there that will have a singular component. And the only way to eliminate the singular component is to make sure that the prefactor of the singular component is 0. And that turns out that the hypergeometric function has to vanish. And this is the root. So this exponent is root of a hypergeometric function. And again, as you can see, completely different than what we had before. Shooting quite a different story. But in the end of the day, it's a root of something, eigenvalue of something. Boom. The exponent. So for tree sequences, the scaling exponent is non-trivial, which was very nice because it tells us that for sure when we go to 4 or 5, it's a non-trivial problem. So for 2, it's just Sparre-Anderson, half. For 3, it's now become non-trivial. Universal. All IIDs in the universe are going to have this number. All of them. It's just a combinatorial problem of how do you arrange 3N numbers. Okay, the bounds are actually very nice. At least this one of those bounds is extremely nice, but I will not tell you because it's too much, not enough time. We can show that this power law behavior is generic, that the exponent roughly grows linearly, as you can see, with the number of sequences. So this is 2, we have that analytically. This is 3, we have that analytically. 4, as you can see, there are error bars because it's numeric. But we have those two bounds. So it is linear up to a logarithmic correction. This is a logarithmic correction, so linear with an asterisk. Okay. So in general, the scaling exponent is non-trivial. And there's even more to the story because I can couch the problem a little bit differently. I told you initially that one is better than, you know, red is better than blue. I can ask the following. Let's say I have n sequences. I can say one sequence better than all the rest. One better than two, better than all the rest. And those are just branches of exponents that correspond to those questions. And this is the case that we're interested in. There's perfect ordering, and there's a whole families of exponents. And those are basically the half exponents generalized into 1 minus 1 over m. And this is the previous exponent with the root of hypergeometric function generalizes in the following root. So one bigger than the rest, one bigger than two, blah, blah, blah. So we call that a scallop, which is beautiful because all those branches are exponents, and we have this branch analytically, this branch analytically, those two lines are numeric. So, and sigma is the problem we started with. So there are special cases of a somewhat more specialized question. So part 3 is... we looked at probability multiple sequences of records are ordered. We looked at uncorrelated random variables, survival probability independent of the parent distribution, power law decay with a non-trivial exponent, exact solution for three sequences, scaling exponents grow linearly with number of sequences. Again, the key is that statistics of a median record, the rank, becomes independent of sequence length. And the scaling method and asymptotics all combined together, a bunch of tools, allows us to tackle nice combinatorial problem. All right, so now I'll change a little bit, but I'll tell you that there's a wonderful connection between this exponent and what I'll tell you later, which is uncorrelated variables are going to tell us something about correlated variables. All right, and this is now the problem of Brownian motion. And in fact, when you think about first passage processes, one of the most tackled problem in first passage processes is actually the single random walk. It's the most celebrated problem. You start a random walk at the origin. What's the probability? Random walk never comes back. Another way to say it is that if you have two random walkers, two Brownian particles, what's the probability they never meet? So this is the most studied problem in first passage. This is the most studied problem. And I'm going to ask another problem, which is, amazingly, it appears, has not been asked before. Is the problem that the maxima of one random walk and the maxima of another random walk are ordered. So, and there's quite a lot of work on maxima of random walks, going to Levy and going to, you know, the 50s. I tend to joke about this, is that we are scientists, we write lots of papers, too many papers, and so most of them don't contribute to our record. And you compare two scientists, and what you really care about is whether the best of one scientist is better than the best of the other. You look at the best paper, I mean, what are you going to look at, yeah? And whether the best remain better than the best. And this is this, you know, the best versus the best. Okay, so is it clear what I'm doing here? So this is time, this is space, this is the trajectory of a Brownian motion, and the blue staircase is the rightmost position to date of that random walk. Excuse me as I'm changing random walks and Brownian motion interchangeably. I know it's a big crime, but it's some deficiency I have. So, all right, so first passage kinetics of Brownian position. So this is the universal probability, which you have seen before earlier in my talk. And it's an amazing quantity because it tells you, people think that it's an asymptotic result, you know, t minus 1/2, exponent 1/2. No, this result holds for random walk of length 1, of length 2. For length 1, it's 1/2. For length 2, it's 3/8. For length 3, it's 5/16. It's exact for finite length walks. That's the beauty of this result. And if you don't think it's beautiful, I'll tell you that it doesn't only hold for random walks. It holds for Levy flights, for things with infinite moment. It holds for everything. So, and this is our baseline. We're going to compare our behavior that I'll be telling you for the position with this sort of Spar-Anderson behavior. It also holds for different mobilities. So here I'm talking implicitly that this is diffusing with some diffusion coefficient d1, this is d2, and d1 equal d2. So this result holds for d1 equal d2 and d1 not equal d2. And we're going to compare with that. All right. So what are we finding for Brownian records, Brownian maxima? What we find, it's not 1 over square root of t, it's 1 over square root of square root of t. T to the minus 1/4. So by what I told you, 1/4 is not a trivial exponent because it's not rational, but I'll show you that it's very beautiful. In fact, is 1/4 equal to 1/2 times 1/2? Can I somehow weasel my way into this 1/4 without doing any work? Okay, numerics, it took us a long time. After a few months of this thing running on a computer, we got to the conclusion that this was really 0/0. And then we got to work. So the exponent is 1/4, and we're going to go to work now. So what do we do? So we have four variables. So we're dealing with diffusion in four-dimensional space. That's just way too many dimensions. So M1 is bigger than M2, if and only one. So the key to solving this problem is very, very simple. is that this blue trajectory is irrelevant. It's very simple. Once, you know, you have the blue trajectory is the trailing scientist. And once this trailing scientist managed to write a better paper than the red scientist, game over. So we don't need to care, we don't need to track about the paper of this trailing scientist because that paper is no good. It's irrelevant. So, okay, we're going to erase that. So think this, about this picture without this red, without this blue staircase. All right. So we're going from four variable to three. Yeah. M1 is bigger than X1, leading maxima, and M2 is bigger than X2, but the two records are always older, M1 bigger than 2. The key observation is the trailing record is irrelevant. M1 is bigger than M2 if and only if M1 bigger than X2. That's our key. So now we have three variables, two positions and one record. The leading maxima and two positions. Okay, now if there's a slide that says from four variable to three, you should be able to guess what the next slide says. It says from three variables to two. We're going to introduce the distance from the record, the distance between the leading scientist and its own record and the trailing scientist and the leading record. And basically, now we have diffusion in 2D, basically. We have the start somewhere here, and as you will see, there's one coordinate which we have drift, but then whenever this trailing scientist catches up, game over. So both those distances undergo Brownian motion because X1 and X2 undergo Brownian motion. So we have a diffusion equation. We have two boundary conditions. One is absorbing and one advecting. Why advecting? Because whenever the leading scientist hits this axis, he breaks his or her own record. So there's drift in this way. And that's what's tricky about this problem is that you have to worry about this boundary condition. And this is the minus sign is going to change sign twice before we're done. But basically, you want to integrate the survival probability and you'll get the total survival probability. You integrate over positions. I'm probably running out of time, so I'll speed up a little bit. The way you solve this, and this is standard in first passage problem, is... the diffusion equation applies to the coordinate and to the initial conditions. So you write, when I write here del square, I'm differentiating with respect to the initial conditions, and all the boundary conditions are with respect to the initial conditions. So what I'm saying here is that I can start here, 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 or here, it doesn't matter. And I'm solving the entire problem. And then I'm saying, well, I'm just going to set the actual boundary condition, and you solve with respect to the initial condition. The solution is, since there's spherical symmetry, spherical coordinates, and we know that we have a parallel tail, so we're going to use dimensional analysis and say that the survival probability is essentially just a function of the angle, coordinate. This is angle 0, this is pi over 2, so it's essentially function of the angular coordinate. This is pretty standard, actually, stuff. And we reduce it to basically a Laplacian for the angular coordinate, and here this is the solution, and this is the eigenvalue, and this is the condition on eigenvalue, and tau beta pi is 1, is basically translation of the boundary condition along this line, the pi equal 2 line, and we'll find a quarter. So we have the answer. It turns out that this quarter, it's a related problem. Let's say you start a random walker in a needle. You just put a needle, and you have a random walker. And the probability the random walker never hits a needle, but the needle occupies just half of space, is also t minus a quarter. The two problems are mathematically related. Now it gets tricky or interesting, because let's have this walker be non-equivalent. So one diffuses with d1, another with d2. Well, it's immediate to transform the problem of two diffusion coefficient into identical diffusion coefficient by this scaling transformation. And now the condition, the boundary condition, still it's pi over 2, but the boundary condition acquires a ratio of diffusivities, and the answer is 1 over pi arctangent. So it's different from the Spauer-Anderson, because it depends on the diffusivities. And when d1 equals d2, you get a quarter. And this exponent is general between 0 and 1/2. Here's numerical verification of this exponent as a function of the ratio of diffusivities. Here are some properties of this exponent. And basically, if you look at a third and three, the sum of those has to go to be half. So basically, if you have a slow particle and a fast particle, they alternate. You know, there's a slow fast first passage process, then they catch up, and then a fast first passage process, and it's like leapfrog. And now I'm done. Multiple particles. So Michael Fisher, and in fact, this is should be very well known to many probabilists. And so the probability that n random walkers are perfectly ordered is n minus 1 over 4. It's diffusion in what's called the wild chamber. Let's do the same for maxima or records. And again, there are a series of exponents, a quarter, 0.65. And if you just normalize the exponent we had for IIDs by 2, you get amazingly good agreement. So this is just numerics, I don't know, but the two could be the same, or at the very least, from IIDs we get extremely good approximation for random walks, which maybe says that these record statistics are rather robust. And maybe I'll just end here, because I'm out of time, yeah? Yeah, it's very simple, because you think about the phase space of all sequences, and you can divide them into two types, like a surviving type and non-surviving type, and now you just count how many configuration you are. So that's why, in that sense, it's the size of the phase space. I think about it really as an entropy of these sequences. So I hope that makes sense. It's just count, you know, the size of it, which is small.
It's the log.
Okay, all right. So I should make that transformation in my definition. But I think you know what I mean. It's the size of the phase space. Yeah.
So I'm not sure I really understand the case that you are making for records being better for data analysis. I mean, it seems if you wanted to do that, you would think about a statistical test and show that there's a more powerful statistical test somehow. And my intuition is that it would tend to be the opposite. If you think about these temperatures in months, and the problem with records is that they're very noisy, because if you get one unusually large value, then that dominates everything else. And whereas, for example, if you just compare all the days and ask how many times was 2002 hotter, then it's, I don't know, one has to do the computation, but it seems like that would be more powerful.
So it's a very well taken criticism, but let me tell you what I have in mind. Specific questions which has sort of a persistence in them, like is year one year always hotter than the other one? Uh-huh. Then for that.
So the question itself is about that.
No, the question is not necessarily about record, it's about the temperature in that year, but I'm saying you could address it by measuring the days one at a time. I'm saying if you have a very specific question like record are systematically, temperature systematically higher in 1 year, records might be better suited for that.
Right, but one could actually come up with a model, right, where you have a null hypothesis and an alternative hypothesis and just see which test is more powerful, at least numerically,
want to
do the computation.
Conceivably, yeah.
Yeah,
I haven't done that, but yeah.
Any more questions?
Rick?
Yeah, maybe I can ask a question. This is maybe for discussion later, but
Have you considered the case where there's sort of two, sort of a grid of records rather than, I mean, a grid of random variables rather than sort of one dimension? In all your cases, you had some time variable, but you could have a sort of two time variables, for example, and then have a record for being, you know, larger than everybody to your left and below you. It seems like a natural sort of generalization from a mathematical point of view.
Okay, so actually in that random walk or Brownian paper, I've done something like that. And I looked actually at Brownian motion in 2D and in 3D. So you would say that, you know, there's the X coordinate, the Y coordinate, the Z coordinate. But then I reduce it to 1D by looking at the radial coordinate. I think the challenge with that is that it's natural to have one coordinate in which you're measuring. So even if you have diffusion in 3D, you have the radial coordinate, like which particle went further along than all other particles. But I think one can get more sophisticated and really have it to truly to the description of what you're saying. And you will have truly N variable here and M variable here, and this survivals are going to be truly two-dimensional object, not reducible to 1D. So yeah, it's... By the way, for this 2D and 3D, it's completely open for the Brownian motion. What is the survival problem? I think that's, I'm sure, a very, very challenging problem. But we have the measurements, and they're published.
Let's thank Ellie again, and...